and feminist, and then kind of delivered to Afghanistan as an export rather than an indigenous feminism in Afghanistan. I think the failure is that, yes, Afghan women might be educated, but they don't have the political capacity to safeguard the rights that they have won in the past 20 days. And that the reason for that is this idea of empowerment as something, you know, excised from political radical struggle. You know, women in Afghanistan were never able to do that in the past 20 years. And
Rafia, we have 20 seconds.
Okay, so, but in terms of the burqa, I mean, those are the theatrics of the West, right? It's this horrible equation that if you're wearing the burqa, you're oppressed. If you suddenly take it off, you're free. And you see, it's truly tragic to see that repeated again 20 years after the initial invasion and as the U.S. draws down. I mean, the burqa is not the indicator of...
We're going to have to leave it there, but I thank you so much for being with us. Rafia Zakaria's new book is called Against White Feminism, Notes on Disruption. And thank you to Mahbuba Siraj and Kabo, president of Afghan Women's Network. I'm Amy Goodman with Ermin Shaikh.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO, Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
Tune in to Talking Earth, a show dedicated to showcasing our local poetry scene. Join hosts Patrick Picard, Barbara Lamorticella, and Walt Curtis for Talking Earth on the second and third Mondays of each month from 10 to 11 p.m. More information can be found on kboo.fm under schedule.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting...
Hi, this is Phil G. I'm one of the hosts of KBOO's Grateful Dead and Friends show, Saturdays from noon to 2. All through August, we have been running a 20th anniversary Sound to Listeners fundraiser campaign to help KBOO get a new studio transmitter link. One of the ways we have commemorated 20 years of Grateful Dead and Friends is with a special Sound to Listeners limited edition t-shirt. The t-shirt is Heather Gray and is available in both unisex and fitted women's style. If you would like one of these limited edition shirts, you can go to kboo.fm and you'll see a picture of the shirt to the right on the homepage. Click on it and follow the instructions, and you can proudly wear your support for KBOO Community Radio everywhere. Plus, you'll know that you have helped KBOO bring sound to listeners. This offer ends Friday, September 3rd at midnight. Thank you for your support of KBOO Community Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Newburgh School Board will consider taking back its ban on Pride and Black Lives Matter flags, Zenith Energy has its oil-by-rail permits denied, and in national news, Hurricane Ida causes dozens of deaths in the Northeast in flash floods.
Yeah.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 2nd, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. The Newburgh School Board voted in a special meeting Wednesday night to table the issue of rescinding its controversial ban on Black Lives Matter and Pride flags, posters, and apparel. Last month's ban received immediate outcry from local teachers' unions, community, and students who say the ban is illegal and that they weren't given the proper opportunity to speak in opposition before it was put in place. The Newburgh Education Association, or NEA, and the ACLU of Oregon are threatening legal action if the board does not rescind the ban. Prior to the decision, spokespeople from the NEA spoke out against the ban, denouncing the board for deciding which flag, poster, sign, or apparel is political or acceptable, and that they will advocate for schools and fight to keep the rogue board in check. Wednesday's special meeting, which was described as contentious, resulted in a 4-3 vote to table the issue. The meeting was closed to public input. Board Chair Brian Shannon moved to table the agenda. He said he wanted to time the reversal of the ban with new policy language, though he did acknowledge he thinks the current policy language adopted by the board is legally enforceable. Superintendent Joe Morlock has maintained that he won't implement the policy if it is unconstitutional or illegal, adding that he received legal advice urging against it. The controversial directive was made on August 10th. It banned signs, flags, attire, or anything deemed too political from staff, students, and classrooms, as well as all school district properties, with particular reference to Black Lives Matter and Pride-related content. The directive passed on a 4-3 vote. Though the issue is tabled for now, many expect the school board to rescind its decision very soon. Zenith Energy's oil-by-rail facility in Portland has long been the subject of scrutiny from local environmental activists. They've cited the hypocrisy of a city like Portland that thinks of itself as green and progressive, yet the energy company planned to expand dangerous oil transportation through the city. Zenith's moves to expand may be shut down, however, with the Department of Environmental Quality refusing to renew permits for the company. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has more.
The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality announced this week that it has denied the renewal of a Northwest Portland-based oil-by-rail facility's air quality permits. Zenith Energy, with its massive storage tanks, serves trains traveling through the Columbia River Gorge and ocean vessels that transport crude oil to refineries, says it plans on appealing the DEQ's decision. The company received the news on Tuesday after the DEQ made the decision following the City of Portland's previous permitting stamp of rejection issued last Friday, which said the facility's operations were not compatible with the city's comprehensive plan. DEQ spokespeople said in a Wednesday statement, quote, "Under state law, when a local government makes a negative compatibility determination, state agencies generally may not approve permits to continue its operation," end quote. The Portland Bureau of Development Services denied Zenith a land use compatibility statement, or LUCS, based largely on its transport of fossil fuels, which, according to City Commissioner Dan Ryan, who oversees the Bureau, says, it, quote, "has the potential to directly impact tribal territories, cultural and environmental resources, and tribal treaty rights." Zenith has also said it plans on appealing the city's decision, maintaining that it intends on increasing its utilization of renewable fuels at the expense of using fossil fuels. The Texas-based company was acquired from previous owners in 2017, who had formerly used the facility for asphalt. Though the previous operating permits were inherited with the change of ownership, Zenith has currently been operating with expired air quality permits. Both environmentalists and local lawmakers have argued the dangers associated with the company's storage and transfer of oil, citing the effects from a fiery oil train derailment or an earthquake-triggered oil spill would be devastating. As the company poises to appeal the recent denials, it has said it will move forward seeking a separate stormwater construction permit from DEQ, which will be required to build a new unloading infrastructure intended for the use of renewable and biofuels. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
The average amount of weekly coronavirus cases has been increasing for the past 8 weeks in Oregon. The surge in cases and in deaths is because of the Delta variant of COVID, which spreads even quicker than the first iteration of the virus. Yesterday, there were 2,827 new cases of coronavirus and 23 new deaths. In total, at least 3,233 people have died in Oregon from COVID since the pandemic began. The surge in cases is overwhelming hospitals, and there are only 8% of ICU beds available across the state. About 100 Oregon National Guard members will be deployed to Salem Hospital to help healthcare workers handle the surge by next Wednesday. Guard members can't perform tasks that require a nursing license, but they can help with administrative tasks and patient care tasks, both of which can be time-consuming for healthcare workers. The University of Oregon and Oregon State University will require weekly coronavirus testing for unvaccinated students and employees as soon as their fall terms begin. If students and staff don't comply, they could face disciplinary action and staff could lose their jobs. UO officials wrote to students and staff on Wednesday, quote, "Current data shows that unvaccinated people are at a very high risk of contracting the Delta variant of COVID-19 and at a significantly greater risk of suffering severe illness from COVID-19. Requiring regular COVID-19 testing for unvaccinated UO community members will help protect this population, detect cases earlier, and help reduce the spread of COVID-19," end quote. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are asking unvaccinated people not to travel this Labor Day weekend. The United States has an average of 160,000 cases per day. Even fully vaccinated individuals need to weigh the risk of travel, according to the CDC. 38% of Americans 12 and older who are eligible to receive a coronavirus vaccine are not yet fully vaccinated. The CDC reported this week that hospitalization rates related to COVID are 16 times greater for unvaccinated people compared to vaccinated ones. Oregon prisons received a failing grade on their response to protect inmates from COVID-19. Oregon was one of only three states to score 0 points, according to this new report by the Prison Policy Initiative. The COVID death rate in Oregon prisons is 5 times higher than that of the rest of the state, and the infection rate is 6 times greater. The report found that most states, including Oregon, didn't make much effort to increase social distancing space by releasing state prisoners during the pandemic. One bright spot in the report, though, Oregon ranked 3rd nationally for its efforts to prioritize vaccinations for inmates. 86% of the statewide prison population was vaccinated when the report was conducted in June. Congress is providing more than $400 million to current and former foster youths in the U.S. through a pandemic aid program. Young adults in Washington who have been in foster care may now receive $1,000 in pandemic-related aid. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Foster care alumni in Washington state have 1 month left to apply for pandemic aid. As part of a larger relief package in Congress last year, Washington is distributing $1.65 million to people who were dependents of the state or tribal foster care programs after their 15th birthday. They must now be between ages 23 and 26. Don Raines is with Treehouse, an organization helping the state's Department of Children, Youth, and Families distribute funds. She says recipients will receive $1,000 at a crucial time.
We know that many of them struggle in the transition to adulthood. They don't have the same kinds of safety nets of families to help with their transition, either through the education, post-high school education, or into the world of employment.
Raines notes that folks are eligible even if they weren't in foster care in Washington state. She says they've reached about 400 people so far of the 2,800 known to be eligible in the state. The deadline to apply is September 30th. Raines says there's a lot of flexibility for how the $1,000 can be used, adding what a difference this amount of money can make.
We're so hopeful that this is going to help people stay housed, to get food that they need, to maintain going to school if that is their path.
Raines sees it as a critical investment for people who have been in foster care.
They are the young people for whom the state became parent, and we have a special responsibility to them to help make sure that they make a successful transition to young adulthood, both for them personally and for all of us.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The last vestiges of Hurricane Ida slammed the East Coast on Wednesday night, setting records for heavy rain and flash flooding throughout the region and claiming the lives of over 24 people. 8 people in New York City have drowned in basement apartments, including a toddler and an 86-year-old. Hurricane Ida is the worst flash flooding event ever documented in the city. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio described the catastrophic ravages on Thursday morning, saying, quote, "We are in a whole new world now. This is unlike anything we've seen before," end quote. Four others drowned in a similar fashion in a complex in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Other casualties were reported for people trapped in vehicles as the waning storm pummeled the coast. Video surveillance cameras showed subways with raging fires on the tracks while waterfalls of water gushed over struggling trains. Over 3 inches of rain were reported falling in Central Park in less than an hour. That shattered the previous rainfall record set by Hurricane Henry just last month. New York Governor Kathy Hochul warned of the effects of climate change, saying, quote, "Unfortunately, we're going to have to deal with these cataclysmic events with greater regularity," end quote. Weather officials say the dangers of flash flooding in densely populated urban areas from increased heavy rain are a result of climate change. In cities, vast expanses of pavement prevent surging water from draining away. According to PowerOutage.us, more than 100,000 people are without power across New Jersey and Pennsylvania, while dozens of flights have been diverted and Amtrak rail systems remain out of commission. Ida first made landfall in Louisiana as a Category 4 hurricane on Sunday, devastating coastal areas with flooding and wind gusts surpassing 150 miles per hour. It left thousands without power and with outages expected to last for several weeks before infrastructure can be repaired. The severity of Ida's descent onto the northern East Coast was unexpected, though. Residents had very little warning of what was coming. To date, Hurricane Ida has taken the lives of at least 28 people from Maryland to New York, with those grim statistics expected to rise. Tina Kotek, president of the Oregon House since 2013, announced yesterday that she is running for governor. In a press release, Kotek said, quote, "I'm running for governor because I know that together we can reckon with the legacies of injustice and inequality to build a great future for Oregon." She continued, quote, "We must get past the politics of division and focus on making real, meaningful progress for families across our state," end quote. Kotek was first elected to the Oregon House of Representatives in 2006 and in 2017 became the first openly lesbian speaker of a state house in the United States. Because of term limit laws, Governor Kate Brown is ineligible to run for re-election. Democrats have held the Oregon governor's office since January of 1987, when Neil Goldschmidt succeeded Victor Atiyeh. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with the team behind a new podcast series produced in Portland called King of the World, which examines American Muslim life after 9/11. At 6, we'll hear Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, stick around for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear skies with an overnight low of 59 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 85. Today in history, in 1838, Liliʻu Kalani, the last sovereign monarch of the Hawaiian Kingdom, was born. She ruled for 2 years between 1891 and 1893 before she was forcibly overthrown and imprisoned in the interest of annexing Hawaii into the United States. She's also known for composing the song Aloha Oi, a common cultural symbol for Hawaii. The quote of the day is from the Queen Regnant herself. She said, quote, "Never cease to act because you fear you may fail." Uncertainty reigns following the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Texas bans abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, and a federal judge greenlights a controversial opioid bankruptcy settlement for Purdue Pharma. With those stories and more, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Now, we have just concluded the largest air evacuation of civilians in American history. It was heroic. It was historic.
Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin discussing the end of the military mission in Afghanistan. American and Afghan allies left behind have entered an uncertain period following the definitive conclusion on Tuesday of U.S. military evacuations. Advocates estimate roughly 150,000 vulnerable Afghans remain in the country, while those who assisted the U.S. military who may now wish to leave with their families could put that number closer to a quarter million. Texas legislation banning abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, well before many women even know they are pregnant, is now the law of the land, effectively ending Roe v. Wade protections in the state. In a move that surprised some high court watchers, the U.S. Supreme Court didn't act on an emergency request to stop the law from taking effect by midnight Tuesday. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
This extreme Texas law blatantly violates the constitutional right established under Roe v. Wade and upheld as precedent for nearly half a century. It will significantly impair women's access to the health care they need, particularly for communities of color and individuals with low incomes.
President Biden met with Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky Wednesday. Zelensky made big requests for the Biden administration, including getting U.S. input on Ukraine's chances of joining NATO, establishing the potential U.S. role in reaching a settlement in the Donbas region of Ukraine, and requesting American assistance in freeing hundreds of individuals imprisoned in Donbas.
And the United States remains firmly committed to Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity in the face of Russian aggression.
COVID-19 cases continue to rise across the country, overwhelming hospitals and filling up ICU beds. Nationwide, vaccination rates went up in August due to the Delta-fueled COVID-19 surge. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear.
Hospitalizations, we are now at a new all-time high, 2,198 Kentuckians in the hospital battling COVID. That means this is as full as we have ever been.
A federal judge on Wednesday approved a controversial bankruptcy settlement for OxyContin manufacturer Purdue Pharma that would shield the members of the Sackler family who owned the company from future opioid-related claims. In a bench ruling, Judge Robert Drain agreed to the settlement plan during a six-hour hearing, setting the stage for the dissolution of the company. Its assets would be transferred to a new firm owned by a trust and used to combat the opioid crisis. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
The Canadian natural gas company Enbridge Energy has spilled over 1 million gallons of oil into the Straits of Mackinac in Michigan through their Line 5 dual pipelines. Governor Gretchen Whitmer has ordered the company to close the pipelines, and now water and environmental groups are urging Canada to back up the order against Enbridge. Lily Bolke has the story.
Water activists are calling on Canadian officials to back Michigan's efforts to close the Line 5 dual pipelines, which have spilled more than 1 million gallons of oil into the Straits of Mackinac and surrounding waters. Governor Gretchen Whitmer ordered Canadian natural gas company Enbridge Energy to close Line 5 in May, but they've ignored the order while challenging it in court. Sean McBriarty with the Michigan-based Oil and Water Don't Mix Coalition says Canada shares responsibility to protect these waters.
You can protect our Great Lakes and our climate and support shutting down Line 5 in the Straits of Mackinac, and you need to do so. Or you can support Enbridge and its fossil fuel agenda, but you can't do both.
Activists and environmentalists gathered near Canadian consulates in Detroit, Chicago, and Windsor to protest Canada's continued support for Line 5. And in Wisconsin, groups gathered at Lake Michigan in Milwaukee. In addition to the pipeline itself, putting the Straits of Mackinac and other Great Lakes waters at risk for oil spills, Jamie Simmons with the Michigan Climate Action Network says continuation of Line 5 supports the burning of fossil fuels. She says in order to prevent the worst impacts of climate change, countries need to cut global emissions in half by 2030 and go net zero by 2050.
Achieving this goal is what Canada agreed to when it ratified the Paris Climate Accord. Allowing Line 5 to continue to operate or to be replaced by a new old tunnel, as Enbridge is proposing, is not consistent with that climate goal.
Enbridge and the state of Michigan are currently in mediation until September 30th. Canadian officials have lobbied the U.S. to keep Line 5 open, but the Oil and Water Don't Mix Coalition urges them to instead focus on a national energy policy that protects the Great Lakes. This is Lily Bolke with Michigan News Connection.
New Mexico Pueblo leaders are calling on the state legislature to rebuild trust with tribes. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The All Pueblo Council of Governors is calling on the New Mexico legislature and staff to make meaningful improvements and rebuild trust with tribes. The calls follow the resignation of legislative staff member Rachel Gudgel, director of the Legislative Education Study Committee. She was reprimanded last year, accused of making disparaging remarks about Native Americans. For months, Pueblo governors and leaders of the Navajo and Apache tribes had sought her resignation. They believed their legislative priorities on education were stifled. Pueblo leaders say the new person to lead the role should have knowledge of cultural diversity and respond to the needs of Native children. In a statement, Acoma Pueblo Governor Brian Vio says it's time for a fresh start, adding the process to find a replacement should include consultation with tribes. A group of high school students from the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, has been staying busy this summer. They're part of a second cohort of students to participate in a summer work program that employs students to engage in their culture. WXPR's Aaron Gottsacker went to work with some of these students to learn more about the program.
It's pouring down rain in Lac du Flambeau, but the rain doesn't stop a group of about six high school students from gathering to carve traditional wooden flutes or shave strips of cedar wood into wild rice knockers. The teens are part of a summer work program called the Lac du Flambeau Youth Cultural Experience. Funded by the Economic Support Office, they spend about 20 hours, 4 days a week, working on cultural projects. Greg Johnson is the program's supervisor.
The goal of this program is to educate and give our kids here an opportunity to work like our ancestors did.
And that's exactly what these students are doing.
We've collected cedar bark. We've made a couple wigwams. We learned how to make traditional flutes. We've learned how to gather traditional medicines.
Lacey Valier is one of the program's participants. Before this summer, she says she couldn't have imagined herself spending her school break learning about this culture. Now, she can't imagine being anywhere else.
It's just being able to bring the culture back after so long, because the wigwam that we built, the type that it wasn't made for over 100 years.
As school gears up for the fall, the summer program is winding down. But the lessons learned this summer will last much longer than a season.
I've picked up a lot of skills that I can use in my lifetime. And yeah, I feel that that will serve me well and others too.
I'm Aaron Gottsacker.
Gila River Indian Community Governor Stephen Roe Lewis and two Native students joined Arizona Governor Doug Ducey Wednesday for the signing ceremony of a bill which ensures students have the right to wear traditional dress to graduation to represent their culture. HB 2705 prohibits school dress codes, which prevent students from wearing traditional clothing or cultural items to graduation ceremonies. Native American state lawmakers introduced the bill and helped get it through the legislature. The Federal Communications Commission is extending the deadline to September 27th to submit applications for four seats on the Native Nations Communications Task Force. Applicants must be elected leaders from a federally recognized tribe or employee authorized to act on the leader's behalf. The task force makes recommendations to the commission about tribal-related issues. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Rural apprenticeships help young people stay in their home communities. That's according to a new report from the Urban Institute. The study was done in Maine, and it demonstrated how expanding access to apprenticeships can help keep younger generations closer to home instead of moving to urban areas to look for work. Lily Bolke has more from Maine.
Rural communities in Maine are shrinking as young people move to cities for work opportunities. But a new report finds that expanding access to youth apprenticeships in rural areas could allow many people to stay in their communities while pursuing a promising career. It looks at four apprenticeship programs, including one in Fairfield, Maine, operated by the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 1253. Zach Boren co-authored the Urban Institute report and says apprentices with IBEW earn great money right out of high school, starting at $17 an hour, and within 4 years can earn roughly $66,000 a year, with full benefits and health care.
Young people who decided to go into this apprenticeship program were earning double the per capita income in Maine while being able to stay where they were, not having to flee their hometowns.
More than 540,000 Mainers live in rural areas, and Boren adds there are barriers to apprenticeship programs. Many 17 and 18-year-olds in rural areas don't have access to reliable transportation, and especially with more and more remote work, high-speed broadband connections. Boren adds that apprenticeships can reach young people before they take on high student debt at U.S. colleges and universities, and he says the U.S. might be served by following the example of countries in Europe with robust apprenticeship systems such as Switzerland, Germany, and the U.K.
The U.S. government is really underinvested in registered apprenticeship, less than $200 million annually, where these European countries are really spending billions to support their systems, offsetting the cost for businesses that want to operate these apprenticeship programs.
The report recommends measures for making sure youth apprenticeship programs can endure, from establishing apprenticeship coordinators to addressing the digital divide and increasing access to public transit and other transportation options. This is Lily Bolke for Maine News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 2nd, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade and Dan Raphael. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, and Nadia Ramlagan. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's The Gap, talk radio aimed at bridging the generational divide. Tomorrow, hosts will be discussing the humanitarian crisis in Lebanon. At 9, it's Radio Zine. At 10, it's Film at 11, hosted by Doug Holm, reviewing the latest films from the multiplex to the art house. And at 11, it's Apex Express. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. We'll be hearing about a new podcast series produced in Portland, King of the World, examining the American Muslim experience after 9/11. Stay with us.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
...2021 marked two decades since 9/11, and the recent exit by American troops from Afghanistan seems to be the end of an era. But the true impact of 9/11 isn't limited to military intervention and occupation. Rafaelion Media, based in Portland, has produced a 7-part podcast series on the American Muslim experience following 9/11. It's called King of the World, and it traces the events following the tragedy, like the war on terror and rising Islamophobia, alongside the coming of age of Pakistani-American Shah Jahan Khan. I spoke with two of the producers of the podcast to learn more.
I'm Shah Jahan Khan. I'm the host of King of the World, as well as a producer with Rafaelion Media.
And I'm Saad Butt, CEO of Rafaelion and producer for the show for King of the World.
Very cool. So to start, can you speak a little bit about Rafaelion? How did your media organization come into being?
Yeah, so it came about a year and a half ago, after the murder of George Floyd. I kind of took a step back to kind of think about, you know, how I could be a part of the conversation that was happening, you know, across the world, and, you know, taking inspiration from the protesters in Portland and people in this community. You know, I decided that I wanted to help my community, which is the American Muslim community, to elevate their voices and get our stories out there. And so Rafaelion, we launched it earlier this year with our first podcast, which is American Muslim Project, which is a weekly podcast just interviewing notable American Muslims that are doing things in music and acting and politics, you name it. And then this is our flagship podcast called King of the World, and we'll obviously talk about it. But yeah, you know, we're starting with the Muslim community, we're starting with podcasts, but the goal is to elevate other community voices as well. So the immigrant community, the LGBTQ community, the Asian American community, and then we'll eventually go into film and TV as well as podcasts.
Okay, sweet. So yeah. So your new podcast, King of the World, is a 7-part series about American Muslim life after 9/11. And the first episode is out now. It's almost the 20th anniversary of 9/11. So this reflection on the impact on American Muslims is obviously very timely. So what inspired Shah Jahan for you to examine your personal experience and the experiences of other American Muslim communities in this way? And Asad, I'd love your input as well.
So originally when Asad had approached me to do a show with him and with Rafaelion, we were tossing around a few ideas. And, you know, I've been a musician and stuff for about 15, 20 years. I've been, you know, an activist in that as well, in my punk band and stuff. I initially was very hesitant because I was like, I'm kind of sick of talking about 9/11, to be perfectly honest. But the approach with this show is that, like it or not, this was an event that defined the trajectory of my life and, you know, for a lot of people in general, but definitely like the American Muslim community for sure. It's a day that you see it all the time. It's pre that and then post that. There's nothing, you know, it's nothing was ever the same. So, and then looking at my own kind of life journey in the last 20 years, one that has included music, it's included recovery. You know, I just celebrated 10 years sober this year. You know, and just all these different kind of facets of my identity. It really appealed to me to look at the last 20 years, looking at the last 20 years along the timeline of my own life and what was going on during those periods of time, you know, along with the wider context of the American Muslim experience, of the national headlines, you know, like as we were going to war, you know, the war on terror was beginning, the Iraq war, Afghanistan, you know, the Muslim ban, the Patriot Act, things like that. So looking at those as they're happening, looking at what was happening in my life, and then talking to, you know, two or three other people that were directly sort of impacted by some of those events, who were, you know, whether it's a Muslim soldier who found himself in Iraq, or a person who was a victim of a anti-Muslim, super violent hate crime. Or, you know, whether it's like talking to a Muslim therapist about what all this stuff means. So once we started to kind of talk about the way it could come together, that's what really like got me super excited about the project. And that's kind of how the name came about too. My name, Shah Jahan, my parents named me, it literally means King of the World. So we were just kind of joking about it and we just realized it was a perfect title. I was technically named after the Mughal emperor who built the Taj Mahal in India. But anyway, so it all just kind of, we were figuring out as we went along, you know, like we would, so it's a new thing definitely for me. It's new for both Asad and I, and then for our whole team as well. It was just very, and it has a very like DIY kind of feel to it, which is something I've always been super into.
I just want to add to that, and that is, you know, originally when we kind of came over, when I was thinking about this, I thought it was going to be a lot more historical. And then as we were talking with Shah Jahan, I wanted him to be the host and share some of the stories. We realized like every time we're talking about something, whether it be the war on terror or the Trump ban or whatever, he had like a personal story that was so compelling. And so it kind of morphed as we were producing this to be, you know, 50-50 about Shah Jahan's life and his journey, you know, set against the backdrop of the American Muslim history over the last 20 years. And it just, it weaves perfectly, we think. We're a little biased, but you know, it's just, it's fascinating to see how he was impacted, and so much of so many things that he's forgotten, or, you know, over the last 20 years that came back, just because we were talking about all these things that happened to the American Muslim community. It's been hard for us. You know, it's been hard for every single American Muslim. We all have stories of othering, Islamophobia, and some of them are worse for some people than others, but we all have stories, you know?
Right, and might I compliment the podcast at this moment? I listened to the first episode and I kind of geeked out on the sound design.
We'll tell our sound designer.
When I say DIY, it's, we have some great, great folks working on it. You know, I hope, you know, Mark and Simon, huge shout outs to those two guys for putting, for sure, putting the whole thing together. But I didn't mean DIY in that sense. I guess I meant in terms of like, it reminds me of like when my band first came together, just kind of like not really like knowing what we're just figuring out as we go along.
Yeah. Jajan did the theme song for it as well.
Nice. So yeah, we'll dip into some post 9/11 talk. I hope that's all right.
Of course. That's the subject of the podcast. Yeah. So I'm kind of asking for it now.
we're in it at this point. So yeah. The phrase post 9/11 is thrown around a lot to explain different phenomena in the past 20 years, whether that's changes in geopolitics or airport security. But as you know, the podcast dives into, it has an extra set of implication for American Muslims. So why do you think it's important to unpack those in the podcast? Are there misconceptions that you would hope to dispel?
I think one of the most important things for people to take away is that, and I mentioned this definitely in the show, and 9/11, essentially, what it did for a lot of, at least for me, I will say, and from folks that I've spoken to, it forced our Muslimness to immediately, overnight, be the most significant thing about us. So in that sense, that's what that term, I think, at least for me, means, living in a post 9/11 era, you know? And so I don't know, Seth, if you wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, taking it one step forward, we had to answer for our religion from everybody, from our friends to our, you know, colleagues to classmates to professors. You know, we were also, I think a lot of us Muslims were also trying to figure out what role religion played in our lives. I think the assumption from the world is that every Muslim is religious, right? And that's certainly not the case. We all know that inherently, but like, you know, we weren't kind of allowed to explore what religion meant to us in this post 9/11 world, because everybody saw us as a Muslim. And so we were always on the defensive and always trying to, you know, like be on the defensive and trying to figure out what it meant to us, while everybody else was kind of forcing this Muslimness on us.
Yeah. And it's all, again, in the context of the post 9/11, when we say stuff like the post 9/11 media landscape, that's also the post internet landscape, you know, that's also the post social media, or the beginnings of social media. So we're literally seeing all of these things kind of happening at the same time, where, you know, everybody, all of a sudden everybody has Facebook and stuff, or you know, Fox News is getting super huge, and there's all this media and stuff like happening. And so all of this is in conjunction with, you know, like us like bombing countries that I'm tangentially from, you know, or like that kind of stuff. So that also, I think, is part of it.
Yeah. And so with the American exit from Afghanistan, which happened just this week, there might be a perception out there that like the book is closed on the after effects of 9/11. Do you think that's true? What aspects are there that persist, and are there lessons to be learned?
I mean, not at all. I mean, I think that with our frankly, our defeat in Afghanistan, you know, like things have been awful there for like 20 years, you know, and it's not just that, the tendency of our media a lot is to kind of like, when things, I guess, flare up, you know, it's sort of like, oh, okay, so this stuff is like back in the news. And then like something else distracts us, or like, you know, we go to that and we kind of like forget that this has been like an ongoing, I mean, Afghanistan specifically has been an ongoing thing. And it was like a really nice place to go and vacation and stuff like that. So I think that we're hoping with this show to, you know, to continually, I feel like part of my life has been just sort of trying to add context to like people's just limited perceptions about stuff. So to just add some kind of like nuance to whatever someone might know, you know, even just literally the other day I was, my mechanic, I was getting my car from him and, you know, he's a great guy and stuff. But I remember, you know, I gave him actually the trailer for this show. And he was like, oh man, yeah. And then inevitably, you know, going into a discussion about like that part of the world, you know, and like, oh, they don't want what we have. And just these very simplistic like ways to not just paint like a whole, like what is the Muslim world? Like, what does that even mean? You know, like it's just the world. There are different countries in the world, some of which are Muslim, you know? And so, yeah, I hope that sort of answers your question. I went on like a million tangents there.
Can I add one thing? And that is, I think that at least for the American Muslim community, I feel like we've, over the last 20 years, we've had these kind of waves where like we think Islamophobia and othering is like over, or the waves are going down. Like when Obama was elected, you know, that was amazing for a lot of people of color in this country. And then, you know, all the things about him being a Muslim, or, you know, like an Arab or whatever, like flared its ugly head, but still, like, you know, Islamophobia was, you know, going up and then kind of came back down. And then Trump happened, and like, you know, I think we all felt like we let our guards down. Like we thought that Islamophobia was kind of solved before kind of Trump and his rhetoric came about. And so I don't think with the Afghanistan war ending, you know, this kind of era of post 9/11 changing or shifting, I mean, I think we're still going to see these waves until, you know, the American community kind of gets to know us better. And I think this is part of that journey for Americans, we hope.
So yeah, to circle back to the podcast, you touched on this a little bit, but what do you hope that people who listen to the podcast come away with?
Yeah, I mean, and this doesn't just apply to Muslims, but if when I say we, I'm saying we like all of my different identities, right? So I'm saying if we don't tell our own stories, others are not gonna tell them for us. I think that there was some period of time where, you know, and we're seeing all these different kinds of conversations and representation in the media, or, you know, for example, in film or whatever, like, you know, it's one thing to like be represented, you know, in a small way in a film or something. It's a whole different thing to have written the film yourself. It's one thing to like be an intern at some legislator's office. It's another thing to like be a senator or, you know, or something like that. So it's kind of like this sort of like maybe second or third wave of creators or people in the public eye. It's our, like, I consider myself maybe somebody who was in this first wave and now using some of those lessons to like be part of this next wave as well, I guess, like with this podcast and stuff. Like, I would hope that people would be able to use a podcast like this as a vehicle to then just like listen to more stuff like this, you know, because like, by, as I said at the beginning, like, this is by no means like meant to be every Muslim story or anything like that. It's just it's one story in this like whole in the whole thing here.
I would just add to that, you know, I think certainly we want other Muslims who have struggled with their identity to understand, with, if they listen to this, that it's okay. Like, we, a lot of us have struggled with this, and we've gone through a lot of shit together. And I think for our non-Muslim listeners, I think of people like my wife, who's not Muslim, you know, like, she's married, she's been married for a couple of years, and, you know, I don't think I've really ever fully explained what it's been like to be a Muslim, you know, in the last 20 years. I mean, she's gotten bits and pieces of it, you know, so people who have Muslims in their family or work with a Muslim, or maybe their best friend is a Muslim, but didn't really know like what it was like for us in the last 20 years, you know, just for them to take away like a little bit of our history and get to know us a little better, and be an ally.
And yeah, one last thing I would say is that these sorts of conversations can be extremely therapeutic. You know, I know this whole project for me was immensely therapeutic, just to having these incredible conversations. And thank you for listening to the episode.
Yeah, you know, I appreciate that.
Those things with my family and stuff just come in, like learning new stuff. And even just today from the launch of the show, I've been getting texts from friends, you know, from that high school. Like, you know, one friend, she literally was like, who the F said that? Who was it? You know, and then in the same text was like, listen, I'm I'm sorry that I wasn't a better friend to you. And just me being like, no, it wasn't about that. But just like, you know, so what an incredible, like, and privileged opportunity. That was a little more than what you asked for.
No, that's awesome. So, I mean, to that end, if our listeners are interested in hearing the podcast for themselves or learning more about your projects, what's the best way for them to do that?
Just subscribe to King of the World anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also go to our company website, Rifelion. That's R like rat. I don't know why I said rat. R-I-F like father, E-L-I-O-N like Nancy, Rifelion. .com/KOTW, and you can find out more about the show, and you can actually just subscribe right from there.
Very cool. And do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't cover?
I think just one last thing is, like, Shahjahan is a remarkable storyteller, and it was just my responsibility to get out of the way to let him do, you know, his job of sharing this experience with the world. And I really think that no matter who you are, you're going to relate to something that Shahjahan has gone through over the last 20 years, and you're going to take away some lessons and learn and have some fun as well.
I guess for me, I mean, I've had the privilege of doing many different things over the last 20 years. I've been toured in a rock band. I've been an actor, a voice actor, and as I said, like a person in long-term recovery. Even I've worked as like a behavioral health consultant. I have a master's in community psychology, but this has been like the most incredible project like I've ever been involved with. So that's like, I think I just wanted to say that. And thank you, Asad.
Yeah.
So much.
Yeah. Thank you so much for speaking with me today. I look forward to hearing the rest of the episodes as they come out.
Yeah. Thanks, Althea. Let us know what you think.
That was my conversation with Shahjahan Khan and Asad Butt, two of the producers behind the new podcast King of the World from Rifelion Media. The first episode of their 7-part series is out now on podcasting platforms. Find links related to this story on our website, kbu.fm. You're listening to KBU News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Stay tuned now for COVID Noise Filter.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
KVC's first shipment of vaccines amid unrest. In early July, the Haitian president was assassinated, sparking a period of great unrest for the nation. The crime rate has continued to rise, and poverty has also risen during the pandemic. While the country has previously seen only sporadic COVID cases, it has recently experienced small clusters of outbreaks. Haitian public health officials worry this means COVID will begin to hit the country even harder. In a much-needed bright spot for Haiti, the country's received its first shipments of vaccines through the World Health Organization's COVAX initiative last month. According to NPR, getting the population vaccinated, however, may prove to be difficult. The nation has taken many precautions against the virus, and most Haitians have largely gone non-impacted by the illness. Some researchers speculated this is because Haitian residents tend to be younger and are therefore less likely to be symptomatic. Because of this and misinformation online, many Haitians are resistant to get the vaccines, which have been made available to all healthcare workers and elderly at centers across the regions. According to NPR, some residents in the country may be resistant to the vaccine simply because the unrest makes them feel as they have more important concerns. Public health experts in Haiti believe that this resistance will die down as the vaccine becomes more widely accessible. And let's hope that is definitely the case.
COVID echoes HIV. The Western world needs to start learning from past experiences with pandemics, including HIV, according to an NPR article.
Yes, indeed. People in low-income countries have suffered from inaccessibility to life-saving HIV drugs that were widely available in countries like the U.S., but not in Africa. And many activists call this a crime against humanity. But advocates in South Africa and Kenya began fighting patents that would prevent the creation of many more affordable generic drugs.
Something similar is actually happening with the COVID-19 pandemic. High-income countries can vaccinate huge portions of their populations because aid is brought to those in low-income countries. They are hoarding vaccines, and many countries don't seem to understand that if one is vulnerable, everyone is vulnerable. Low-income countries are paying higher prices.
Yes, indeed. Now, countries need to focus on fair distribution of vaccines for HIV and COVID. Promote the creation of organizations like PEPFAR and the Global Fund, whose focus on financial and distribution development of medicines. Not allow companies to monopolize on life-saving medicines and expand the creation of affordable and generic medications.
Advocates for HIV and AIDS from decades ago are now doing the same thing for COVID-19. We have the knowledge and resources to make these changes and ensure equitable access to quality healthcare.
Again, truer words have not been spoken. Julia, thank you so much for bringing a story like this to the forefront. It is so incredibly important.
Yes.
Many COVID deaths counts may be inaccurate. In the first week of August, the official global death toll was around 4.27 million people, according to a study from the Center for Global Development. However, this count may be inaccurate due to inadequate reporting within many nations. The study, published in late July, studied death data in Indian civil registries and found that between 3.4 and 4.7 million people died between the pandemic period of January 2020 and June 2021 than would have been predicted. This is called measuring the excess deaths, where analysts compare the death toll within one period to a previously similar period of time. The finding is around 10 times more than India's official death toll. Now, according to NPR, undercounts are happening in many other countries as well. In the U.S., One Health Metric Institute estimates that the real death toll is 200,000 more than the official count. The excess death model doesn't include cause of death in the data set, but relies on the assumption that the additional deaths are part of the toll of a health crisis like pandemic. So deaths because of getting sick with COVID are included, but so are those who may have died because they were unable to seek treatment or committed suicide because of the pandemic stress. In India, there are a number of reasons why this undercount may have occurred. One of the major causes is administrative. Many people from nearby regions go to places like Delhi for medical treatment. If they die while seeking treatment in Delhi, they could be cremated there, but stay on record as residents in another state. So their death essentially goes uncounted in both jurisdictions. Some Indian residents also believe the nation's politicians have worked to suppress news of rising COVID cases. In closing, according to NPR, finding more accurate deaths is essential to understanding the shortcomings of the public health response and could shed light on vaccine inequality and long-term effects on rising death rates. The New York Times has an article centered around stopping myths about the vaccine and its relation to women, written by doctors from the Yale School of Medicine. Before we begin, we want to acknowledge that the huge toll of women have had to endure this past year in terms of career and home life. In addition, now some women are forced to be scared to take the vaccine because of rumors. That's right, rumors. Insidious, terrible, horrible misinformation and rumors on the potential issues with fertility and nursing children. That does not exist. There is no data on this. Even reading this story makes me cringe because that just doesn't even exist. But Okay. Now, early clinical trials did not include nursing moms or women that were pregnant, so we understand the hesitation, but many social media platforms have spread misinformation that the vaccine causes infertility. It doesn't, because antibodies target both the coronavirus as well as a placental protein called syncytium 1. That's wrong. It does not. There's no notable similarity between the two proteins. The vaccine is designed specifically for the coronavirus spike. There is no there. So doctors tested women who've had COVID-19, found no interaction between the antibodies from COVID and this protein that is on the placenta. There's also no evidence to suggest that recovered women have lost their fertility abilities, and many women have conceived children after having COVID and being vaccinated. So there. All right, that's real information. But my goodness, does this misinformation spread so much faster? Okay, what about breastfeeding? So with regards to breastfeeding, according to these doctors, women who get immunized both help the mother and the baby. So there's an advantage there. If a woman gets immunized, the idea is that the antibodies from the vaccine would pass to the baby through breast milk. If this happened, though unlikely, it would not be dangerous for the baby. The risks and benefits need to be assessed when deciding to get the vaccine. If a pregnant woman is unlikely to be exposed to coronavirus, then it seems practical to wait until after the delivery of the baby or until more at-risk people get immunized and we have more data. But in closing, other vaccines have been administered to pregnant women safely, and animal studies do not suggest that COVID vaccine would be any different. We also do know that pregnant women are at higher risk of contracting COVID-19, which poses potential threats to the health of the mother. So please don't underestimate the risk of COVID-19 and don't overestimate the risk of vaccines. Just as a reminder, that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hey, KBOO members. It's time once again to vote and make your voices heard. KBOO's 2021 annual membership meeting and board election is coming up on Sunday, September 26th, from 1 to 3 p.m.